Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Happy to tell you once again today that we are sponsored by Simply Safe Home Security. Protect your home the smart way without the expensive long-term contracts. Using Simply Safe Home Security, visit simplysafe.com/ricochet for more details. And we'll have more details later in the podcast about a great holiday special they're offering right now. That's Simply Safe, SimpliSafe.com/ricochet. And Jim, this is not an official good martini, but it's great news. We actually have a normal agenda today. Good, bad, and crazy after 9 consecutive crazy martinis, and possibly more if you go back to last week.
The streak is broken. I thought we were on pace for a Cal Ripken there, but the world is less glaringly, obviously, unignorably crazy today.
We had multiple good martinis to choose from today. We decided to go with this one, and that is that it looks like the recount insanity is headed towards a conclusion in Wisconsin. It's heading towards a conclusion because they're almost done counting the votes. Some are doing it by hand. Some are doing it by machine because the judge left it up to local officials to do that. Jim, you report today in the Morning Jolt the Wisconsin presidential recount is 70% done. Milwaukee has already finished, and so far Hillary Clinton has gained a whopping 82 votes out of a Trump lead of more than 22,000. So that looks fairly safe unless they just conjure up ballots in Dane County by the fistful. Over in Michigan, there had been some dueling court decisions about whether or not this recount should proceed. A federal judge earlier in the week said yes. Then the Michigan Court of Appeals said no. Then a 3-judge panel of the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals at the federal level said yes. Then the federal judge looked at the Court of Appeals decision and said, yeah, you're right, Jill Stein had no standing here. She had no chance of winning. I never should have allowed this thing to go forward. So now Jill Stein is challenging this decision in front of Michigan's Supreme Court. And Jim, based on what I know about the Michigan Supreme Court, her odds of winning that are very, very poor. And of course, she never really got off the ground in Pennsylvania. So with the Electoral College actually meeting on December 19th, it looks like perhaps all three of these states might actually have all this nonsense taken care of well in advance.
Yeah, it seems like really common sense to me, Greg, that if the losing candidate doesn't want a recount, and if the losing candidate doesn't believe that there was any chicanery or any wrongdoing or foul play or shenanigans, then why should we do this? Right? Like who, what, you know, who's going to have a greater, you know, incentive to explore that option than the primary losing candidate? And so the argument from Michigan Republicans was, look, she was in fourth place. She had 1% of the vote. She did not have standing to ask for a recount, because if, you know, this kind of does open the door that at this point, Irving Schmidlap, who gets 2 votes as a write-in, is going to be able to say, ah, you know, I was wrong. We need to do it. Also kind of pleasing in this this judge's ruling, I like the term, the voting system is so secure that, quote, not even the gremlins, Martians, or Russian hackers could tamper with it. Now, that's really good, Greg. Right? I mean, we're pleased with Simply Safe. Simply Safe must be handling ballot security, if not even Martians, right? We've all seen Mars attacks on Independence Day. This was just like 8 pages of pure concentrated common sense. This is Judge Mark Goldsmith, and I kind of, you know, we were going to do our end of the year awards, a strong contender for one of my Man of the Year nominees, just because this year, you know, everything this makes, you know, sense. Where he says, look, you have not presented evidence of tampering or a mistake. You presented speculative claims going to the vulnerability of the voting machinery, but not actual injury. Potential fraud is not enough to continue to allow the recount to proceed. And he also points out that it's going to cost a lot of taxpayers too much money for, you know. So, look, in all cases, the decision to go forward with a recount is going to be something of a judgment call. You know, how big's the margin? In this case, it was, you know, 22,000. I'm sorry, actually, it was 10,000, I believe, in Michigan.
Right.
How many are they finding in the initial recount? When they, you know, they do their quick sampling, double check it. Everything seemed to be checking out. There isn't any scenario in which not only does a recount not alter the results of the presidential election. Nobody's pointed to anything where in one of the U.S. House elections or any state or local election that there was any type of a margin of error or margin of mistakes that would change the result. So why are we spending millions and millions of dollars to do this? Sadly, we have not had a judge do the same thing in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is starting to show us pretty much what we expected here. Lo and behold, 82 votes have changed. Woo! You know, and there's 22,000 vote margin. It's not going to change anything of serious significance. Yes, Jill Stein has paid some of the expenses of this, I guess $3.5 million to the Wisconsin recount. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel helpfully points out that adds out to $58,000 for each vote that Stein has gained in the recount. Boy, all you Stein donors, hope that money well spent, huh?
Absolutely. Oh, a couple of thoughts here. First of all, in Michigan, the legislature had actually been drafting up legislation and would have made it retroactive to Jill Stein had this recount been completed, that any candidate who loses by more than 5% has to fund the whole recount. And I don't know if that actually advanced to the point of getting passed.
It just seems like common sense, right? I mean, the closer it is, the more reasonable it is to have a recount. But, you know, once you get past 5%, you're talking about margins of thousands, tens of thousands of votes, and you're just not likely. You know, history tells us in these giant statewide recounts we've seen in places like Minnesota and Washington, you know, there's this perception on the right that Democrats always find enough votes when they need it. Look, you're never going to get more than a couple hundred. So once the margin is beyond 1,000 votes, it's really tough to see what a recount would do other than waste everybody's time and money.
I think a lot of folks will also be reassured by your statement earlier on in your response there, Jim, that there was neither chicanery nor shenanigans. And if neither are happening, we can be pretty confident.
It was not a travesty, it was not a sham, and it was not a mockery, making it not a travesty mockery.
Just thinking, Jim, as I'm watching some of the cable news as we're recording this, on mute, of course, that yesterday, because a lot of the Democrats are really upset about Trump's pick to lead the EPA, that we got those picks yesterday. Scott Pruitt, EPA, John Kelly, DHS, and Linda McMahon for Small Business Administration, which leads me to think that maybe, just maybe, Vince McMahon is on the short list for press secretary, because that would be awesome.
I had noticed, Greg, that, you know, this was the, you know, 10th or 11th straight Trump appointee that the general reaction on Twitter was, oh, my God, I can't even believe he picked this one. This is the worst nominee since the last one. You know, and listeners know I'm not a huge fan of Trump. I suppose I could make the argument that I have to recuse myself on this one. My brother worked for WWE for a few years. He stopped. He moved to a new job about 6 months ago. I did, thankfully, not during his employment, was when I was referring to Linda McMahon's giant pile of money running for the Senate.
Yes.
Up in Connecticut. You know, technically, she was running as well, but his best thing of her campaign is just a giant pile of money that was doing so. Look, you know, my pop quiz to everybody who's going off the charts apoplectic about the McMahon nomination. Look, name the current SBA administrator.
Good point.
Two, name three things the SBA does. It's supposed to be like, well, it administrates small business stuff, gives loans, you know, like I look, she might be great. She might be terrible. I am just burned out on the, you know, blah, how can you nominate this person? I'm still recovering from the war with China we had Friday night over the call to Taiwan. Never mind that Taiwan is saying, we love the ambassador nomination. Governor Branstad's a great guy. He's an old friend of China. So I you know, all the Trump critics out there, look, Lord knows I've been with you in past times, but you got to pace yourself, guys.
Calm down. It's not good for your health. All right, on to the bad martini today. And Jim, we've kind of talked about this at times, but Jazz Shaw over at Hot Air has chronicled it well. He says, you're going to be seeing a shift in the way the media covers the news in the coming years with the change in management at the White House. Even though the inauguration is still quite a few weeks away, that process has already begun. Just to take one of the more glaring examples, which you can reliably track each and every month, let's take a look at the Washington Post coverage of the jobs report, which comes out every month. When the September jobs report came out, we were still in the period where everyone needed to be, quote, thanking Obama for the robust economy and looking forward to Hillary Clinton extending the same policies after she inevitably won the election. Here's the Post in September. Now the good news is that we got a little bit closer with the 156,000 jobs the economy added in September. But the even better news is that the unemployment rate is ticking up from 4.9 to 5.0%. That's because it did so for the happy reason that so many more people had either found a job or were looking for one. Then in October, The U.S. labor market continues to show signs of gradual strengthening, adding 161,000 jobs last month. Annual wage growth surged to levels not seen since the financial crisis, while the unemployment rate dipped to 4.9% in October from 5% the previous month. And then it showed that the economy is steadily emerging from the shadow of the Great Recession. The November jobs numbers come out in the first part of December, the first report since Donald Trump got elected. And it says that the economy has snapped back substantially since the recession, but it's often the quality, not the quantity of the jobs that is in question. Many Americans are still cobbling together a living with one or several part-time jobs. Overall, the number of people working part-time has risen 9.1% from 2002 to 2016 and now totals 26.4 million, according to government data cited by Golden. Jim, we've been talking about this for a long time. A lot of these jobs, even though it's positive job growth, are part-time jobs, not well-paying jobs. Wages have largely been stagnant, although they've gotten slightly better in the last few months. And suddenly it's a problem now that we've got a Republican coming to the White House.
I was about to say, our objection here, Greg, is not that finally major economics reporters and mainstream media voices who cover the economy are echoing the exact same things we had observed and been talking about for years and years. Our objection is the timing. We sound like those paranoid people during the Bush years. Sure, the terror alert went up. I question the timing. look, yeah, right? I mean, we've been saying this for years now. We've been saying this observation, and I think that, yes, while the unemployment rate went down, people, if you were making, you know, $80,000 before the Great Recession, and you come back and you find one that's paying $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, yeah, you're going to get by. You're going to be okay. You're not going to get evicted. You're not going to get your family's not going to starve. You're going to, you know, you'll get by, but you feel like you've lost something, right? And I think somebody had there was a CNN town call talking to people who voted for Obama and then voted for Trump. And somebody had said, look, I want to take my family on vacation. I want to have some money I can put aside for college for them. I want to worry, think about my retirement. All these like ordinary concerns that, you know, you and I had used the term that most economics we get to look at the jobs report, we look at the economics numbers, GDP. We basically looked and said, well, the economy's treading water. We're kind of sputtering along. Maybe there's a little bit of growth here. The energy sector's doing all right. Other places aren't. Other sectors of the economy aren't. Look, this is what we've been saying for a really long time. Now, if the press is going to cover this all the time, that's fine. But I don't like this idea that's on or off switch or maybe a dimmer switch of the tone. And I knew you could see this coming, Greg. Do you know what I heard about today for the first time in what felt like 8 years?
What's that?
The homeless. They're back.
Like clockwork.
They disappeared for 8 years, but now all of a sudden, boo-boo, here they are. And now all of a sudden people are suffering in the Trump economy and things like that. I was really struck, by the way, Greg, when I saw it was Rolling Stone, which is, you know, technically not real journalism. Probably if anything fits the term fake news, it's that. But they had done something on the Standing Rock protests. And I guess because they turned protesters claiming they'd been beaten or had violent exchanges with the cops, they said it was an example of it's a new example of Trump's America. Greg, when's Inauguration Day?
Next month.
Was it? Okay, because it sounds like, according to Rolling Stone, Trump's America already here. We're already happened. He says, I think in the article it said this is a reflection of Trump administration policies towards protesters. Like, he's not even in office, and somehow all of a sudden, you know, government decisions they don't like are being attributed to him. Is there anything he can't do, Greg?
Not positive, apparently. Yeah. Man. Yeah, I love your reference to the homelessness. I remember as soon as Bill Clinton beat George H.W. Bush, that issue evaporated, and the same month, turns out, hey, you know what? The economy's actually not that bad after all.
Go figure.
Jim, you can't count on the media, but you can count on Simply Safe Home Security to be there and be consistent and stable day after day. Are you traveling for the holidays? Are you having family over? Maybe a quiet day in? However you plan to celebrate, take our advice. Protect your family and your home first. Right now, our friends at Simply Safe Home Security are having a massive holiday sale. Take $200 off, $200 off the Simply Safe Defender Security Package. It's Simply Safe's biggest deal ever.
You must check out this alarm system. It has everything to protect your home. 17 high-tech wireless sensors, police dispatch and alarm monitoring. There's a blaring siren, a panic button, and this award-winning around-the-clock protection is just $15 a month, three times less than the other guys. There's no long-term contract, no installation cost, and no hidden fees.
Around the holidays, there's always a rise in burglary, so make sure that your home stays safe. Save $200 right now at simplisafe.com/ricochet. That's spelled SimpliSafe.com/ricochet. One more time, SimpliSafe.com/ricochet for $200 off your new SimpliSafe Defender security package. And Jim, we're not done trashing the media here, and for good reason. Let's move to the crazy martini. Last night, The Legacy of Barack Obama aired on CNN. I had something else to do. Can't remember exactly what it was, but anything probably would have been better than that. It was hosted by Fareed Zakaria, the noted plagiarist, and he set his sights on congressional Republicans as the evil villains in the early days of the Obama administration, including what he all but described as a smoke-filled room during the inauguration balls in January 2009.
It seemed like a fairy tale beginning. But at precisely the moment the first couple began swaying on the dance floor, the central crisis of the Obama presidency was already taking shape.
Within half a mile of where Obama and Michelle are dancing and celebrating their great victory, his Republican opponents are whining and dining and plotting his defeat.
15 of the most powerful Republicans in Washington made a pact that night.
Out of that meeting, they decide that the only way to win back power is to oppose Obama at every level.
That fierce, unrelenting opposition would haunt the next 8 years. And what began as whispers is now discussed openly. Did race play a role in the brick wall of Republican resistance to Barack Obama?
Holy cow, Jim, with the ominous music and the 15 Republicans, you'd think you got this smoke-filled room with, like,
the shadowy cabal.
Boss Tweed and the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson. They showed pictures of who was there. Frank Luntz, Fred Barnes, John Ensign, John Kyle, Jim DeMint, Newt was there, Paul Ryan, and several others. But David Axelrod then comes in after that and says it's indisputable that there was a ferocity to the opposition and a lack of respect to him that was a function of race. Amazing.
Was there intense, staunch opposition to Barack Obama? Yeah. You look at that, I think the Occam's razor explanation is that Barack Obama is by and large a man of the left. You can, whether the appropriate argument is liberal, whether the appropriate argument is progressive, whether the appropriate label is hard left. But most Republicans in office were conservatives, and there were more than a few conservatives who looked at Obama and said, look, the media had given this guy a free ride throughout the 2008 primary. And I think that the documentary is a pretty good example of that. That the folks of Fareed Zakaria were so wedded to this fairy tale narrative, as he literally describes, it was a fairy tale beginning to the Obama presidency, right? That, you know, that he had never been fairly vetted, he had never been fairly evaluated, and he had been sold to the American public under false pretenses. That here was there was a Newsweek cover shortly after Obama's inauguration saying we are all socialists now. Right. Obama did not run as a socialist in 2008. He did not say to America, I am going to be a socialist. The whole sales pitch was, oh, there's this completely sensible, moderate, post-partisan healer, yada, yada, yada. And then he gets into office and all of a sudden it's I won. And all of a sudden it's very clear that the country is going to lurch very far to the left. Much further than the perception was during the campaign. And there's this great, indeed, the attitude of the likes of Rahm Emanuel was never waste a crisis. In other words, the country's in a really bad spot, so we get what we want, right? We're not, you know, now I was very easy to conclude that those first couple of years of the Obama presidency, the slogan wasn't never waste a crisis, it's never solve a crisis. But there's a reason that there was this great Republican anger for this. It had, you know, could you find people who would blame it up on race? Yeah, you probably could find some in the mix. But I think it's a great insult to the people who opposed Obama throughout then. And it is an extremely convenient and I'd say arguably fundamentally dishonest rewriting of history to contend that the majority of opposition to Barack Obama, starting with congressional Republicans and spreading out through the Tea Party movement, the infamous CNBC rant about, you know, subsidizing your neighbor's house purchases and stuff like that. To argue that all boiled down to race is a great insult to people. And I think, you know, if Fareed Zakaria wants to know why do people buy into fake news? Because they don't trust the existing news media. And I think reports like this that present such a ludicrously one-sided representation of his recent historical events that everybody remembers is one of the reasons people don't trust the news media. And I say this as somebody who appears on CNN and thinks a lot of people over there are doing the best job they can. This was a heavy-handed, one-sided agitprop documentary that I think even Michael Moore might have said, whoa, 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 that's going a little far.
Do you know how many drooling racists there have to be in this country to get the election results in response to Obama's policies after 2, 6, and 8 years if this narrative is correct? I mean, it's just insane.
Well, the weird thing is that then apparently, like, in a course of 4 years, Florida became racist, Pennsylvania became racist, Ohio became racist. I guess North Carolina had been racist in 2012, but not 2008. Indiana was not racist in 2008, went back to being racist again. Michigan, Wisconsin, you can just go down the list. All these states that had somehow not been racist, somebody flicked a switch and they became racist. And the weird thing is, Greg, they became racist against a white woman. If they're really that racist, you think they would have flipped around the other way. But no, then people are going to say, ah, oh, how can Jim and Greg make light of such terrible racism? Yada, yada, yada. Here we go again. Yeah.
Wow.
End of the year's coming, huh, Greg?
Quite a crazy one. We got some fabulous nominees for our end of the year awards after a year like this, and those will be coming not too long from now. So, Jim, good to be with you today. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And a reminder to check out our friends at Simply Safe Home Security. Go to simplysafe.com/ricochet, SimpliSafe.com/ricochet, and check out their offer for $200 off your new Simply Safe Defender security package. Join us again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.